The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Nancy Spain, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. And here's round one, which tests their vocabulary. Two marks if they get the meaning of these words more or less right. Nancy Spain, beginning. What is a walloon? W-A-L-L-O-O-N.
Well, somebody who has lived in what speaks Flemish. It's one of those countries, the Netherlands.
Which one?
Belgium.
Yes. I speak subject to correction, Nancy. I don't think they speak Flemish. It's that they've got a dialect of their own, which is a form of French. They run right along that border, apparently, both on the French side and on the Belgian side. And it's either the people or the language, whichever you like. Walloons. Two marks. Hank Muir, what is lockage? L-O-C-K-A-G-E.
Lockage.
Lockage.
Very good question. I compliment you, Jack. Lockage is the incidence of lockery on canals or any form of inland waterway.
That's right. It's the amount of rise or fall affected by canal locks. It also could be a toll that you pay for getting through a lock. No doubt you've done that in your time, Frank. And if you stole that, it would be the rape of the lockage, no doubt. Two marks still. Dennis Powell, what is a kraken? K-R-A-K-E-N.
Kraken.
It's not a very friendly creature. It's a kind of monster, I think.
Yes.
I think it lives in the sea.
Yes, it does. And about how big, Dillis?
Oh, very, very large.
Yes, all right. It's an enormous mythical sea monster which every now and then used to float to the surface of the sea off Norway, and people thought it was an island and built churches and houses and things on it, and it sank again. Rather nasty. Two marks. Tennyson wrote about it, and so did John Wyndham. Dennis Norden, what is urticate? U-R-T-I-C-A-T-E, urticate.
Urticate is to indicate by giving somebody a very painful nudge. Now, wait a minute, is it anything to do with urticaria?
Yes.
Urticaria. It's a rash.
It's yes, what kind of rash?
Skin trouble.
Yes, but it's a particular rash.
It is a particular rash, yeah.
I'm going to give you a half mark, Dennis. It's to sting like a nettle. And what you were talking about, urticaria, I think is normally called nettle rash. Nancy Spain, what is trichosis? T-R-I-C-H-O-S-I-S. Trichosis.
It's something to do with the scalp.
Yes.
Well, I suppose...
Anosis of the scalp.
Yes.
That's it.
Is there something wrong with it?
Something wrong with it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Shifts.
Itch. Let's have it, Nancy.
Well, it's something wrong with your scalp.
Yes. Any morbid condition or disease of the hair or scalp. Good enough. Good enough. Hank Miller, what is otology?
Ology is the science or study of.
Yes.
Otology, the study of pottage.
Nope. It's the science or study of the diseases of the ear. Or
what
the anatomy of the
dreadful program, isn't it? Itches, twitching scalps, and ears falling off. Well, let's change the subject. Let's play whist.
Sort of ear, nose, and oat. Back to Dillis Powell. The meaning of the word miff, M-I-F-F.
Make a mess of, make a muddle of.
I'm going to give half a mark for that, but not more, because apart from the slang use, it is a huff or a petty quarrel, or to pick a quarrel with somebody, or to take offence with them. And Dennis Norden, what is a vedette? V-E-D-E-T-T-E.
Vedette?
Vedette? Yes. Vedette.
Vedette, which is a film star. That's right, yes. La grande vedette du film, Petula Clark. Yeah.
It was something, like most film stars, it was something else before it was a film star. Do you remember what that was?
Cement labourer.
lorry driver.
Lorry driver. I studied English, but I gave it up.
I think I've got to give you your two marks, Dennis, because that is the common usage nowadays, at any rate in colloquial French, but it was before that a mounted sentry placed in advance of an outpost.
Yes.
And before we start round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and I want two women members of the team to study their quotations, and at the end of the programme I shall ask them where the quotations come from. And Nancy Spain and Dennis Norden, your quotation is, "Put not your trust in princes." And Dennis Powell and Frank, yours is, "Here lies one whose name was writ in water." And then at the end of the programme, I asked Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these words came to be said or written, and I don't want any of these answers yet. Well, the second round is a round on what's the difference between. Two marks, if you get it right. Nancy Spain, the difference between ordnance and ordinance. One has an I in the middle and the other hasn't. Ordnance and ordinance.
Well, one is to do with guns.
Yes.
And that has not an I in the middle.
Quite. And the other one, ordinance.
And somebody who has power to appoint the Lords spiritual.
One and a half, I think, is being a bit generous. Ordnance, without the I, is mounted guns or cannon or branch of public service dealing with guns and ammunition, Royal Army Ordnance Corps, and Ordnance Survey, because they carry out mapping as well. Ordinance is a decree or an authoritative direction. It could be a religious rite, and that's what you get your half mark for. Frank, now, difference between pathos and bathos.
Pathos is the condition of sorrow and sadness.
Yes. And
bathos is from the sublime to the goblime, isn't it?
All right, before we have any indelicate examples, I'll give you your two marks. Pathos, quality in speech or writing, which excites a genuine pity or sadness. And bathos, with the B, is falling from the sublime to the ridiculous, a wild anticlimax. Now, Gillis Powell, difference between antimony and antinomy. One has the M first, and the other has the N first.
Antinomy. Must be antinomy. Nomos. Laws.
Yes.
About the laws. Yes. It's a kind of contradiction.
Yes, that's it.
Contradiction.
And the other one, antimony.
That's metal in a jar.
It's a metal in a jar. It's a metallic substance, flaky, crystalline substance. The other one is a contradiction in a law, or between one law and another. Two marks to it. Dennis Norden, a llama and a llama with two L's, which I think is called Llama or Yama. L-A-M-A and double L-A-M-A.
Well, there's an L of a difference. a llama with one L is a Tibetan monk or priest.
Yes.
And the one with two L's is what they've got in the children's zoo.
Yes. It's a South American ruminant, allied to the camel, but a great deal smaller, without a hump, and has woolly hair, which you can use for spinning into stuffs. And Lama is a Tibetan or Mongolian Buddhist monk. Well, the next round is literary. I give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to complete it by giving the next line or lines. Two marks if they complete it reasonably correctly, and two more for saying where it comes from. Nancy Spain. "'Tis sweet to hear the watchdog's honest bark bay deep-mouthed welcome as we draw near home."
Oh.
Isn't that great? It's a long narrative poem.
That's it.
By somebody who writes in rhyming quatrains.
Yes.
Well, we only have two friends who write in rhyming quatrains.
Robert W. Service.
And Lord Byron.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there only are two poems that you ever have on this programme.
Yes.
One is Don Juan.
All right, stick to that.
Oh,
well done, Nancy, by process of elimination. It's Byron's Don Juan. Can you possibly complete it?
No, I cannot possibly complete it.
All right, you get two out of four. "'Tis sweet to hear the watchdog's honest bark bay deep-mouthed welcome as we draw near home. It is sweet to know there is an eye will mark our coming and look brighter when we come. Don Juan bowed. Pretty good. Fechner, leave to Robert Browning, Biggers, Fleas and Vines, leave to squeamish Ruskin, poopish Epimines.
Leave to somebody else entirely the two ensuing lines.
That's exactly what I want you to do.
Doesn't seem a sort of poem, actually.
Yeah.
Most poems don't mention other writers.
It isn't quite
Russell
a poem.
Russell doesn't whistle.
No.
You wouldn't know, wouldn't
No. Do. I don't think you're going to get it, Frank.
No, it's quite obvious from my face.
It's this Charles was. Kingsley. It's in a poem which was written in a letter to Thomas Hughes. And it goes like this. Leave to Robert Browning, Beggars, Fleas and Vines. Leave to squeamish Ruskin, Popish Apennines. Dirty stones of Venice and his gas lamp 7 weave the stones of Snowdon and the lamps of heaven. All right, on to Dilys Powell. Such men as he be never at heart's ease whiles they behold a greater than themselves.
Sounds like Shakespeare.
Yes.
A historical play?
Yes.
A Julius Caesar play?
A Julius Caesar play it is, by Shakespeare. Now, can you go on and complete the quotation?
We're talking about Cassius, are we?
Yes, we are. Johnny.
Talking about Cassius. We have it again. Let's Cassius. Sort of
such men as he be never at heart's ease, whiles they behold a greater than themselves.
No, I don't think I'm going to get it, really.
And therefore are they very dangerous. I rather tell thee what is to be feared than what I fear, for always I am Caesar. It's the same one which he says, would he were fatter, but I fear him not. But it is Shakespeare, Julius Caesar, Caesar talking about Cassius.
Could be about me men that are
three
friends.
Marks,
yes.
I think,
yeah.
Would be fair. Now, Dennis Norton. Herminius smote Mamilius through breastplate and through breast, and fast flowed out the purple blood over the purple vest.
Smashing a bit of poetry, isn't it? Is it that Horatio keeping the bridge?
It's the same chap. The same poet.
Same chat.
Chap. No, same
poet. Lake Regulus.
Battle of what?
Lake Regulus.
Yes.
The Battle of Lake Regulus is my name.
By
Macaulay.
Yes, quite right. Could you do a completion or not, Dennis?
Well, I couldn't do a word of it. Thank you.
All you have to do is turn it inside out and then you get it.
Turn the best inside somebody else.
Someone smote somebody else.
Yes, that's it.
And purple ran with purple. And hopeless was the... Go on, Dennis. Anybody can write this.
I think... I don't think Dennis is going to get that. Two for Macaulay, Lays of Ancient Rome, Battle of Lake Regulus or Regulus, I don't know which it is. And it goes like this. Herminius smote Mamilius through breastplate and through breast, and fast flowed out the purple blood over the purple vest. Mamilius smote Herminius through headpiece and through head, and side by side these chiefs of pride together fell down dead. Sort of Tweedledum and Tweedledee.
I didn't know that, and I'm glad. You hear glad.
All right.
Give glad an easier one next week.
Well, the next round is much more serious. It's characters from fiction. total of three marks, if you can give me who the following characters were, in what work they appear, and what the writer was. Which writer? Nancy Spain. John Ridd.
John Ridd.
Ridd. R-I-D-D.
Lorna Doone.
Yes, by?
Mighty Thews.
Yes.
By R.D. Blackmore.
And he's the...
He's the fellow with the mighty thews.
Yeah.
Hero.
Hero, that's what I wanted. Three marks. Hero of Lorna Doone by R.D. Blackmore. Frank Muir, Mellors.
Oh, yes. Mellors, yes. Mellors was a chap that Lady Chatterley met in the wood. And she was a chap, she said, I'm game if you are. He was the... He was the gamekeeper.
Yes,
Lady Chatterley's lover, in the book of the same name.
By
D. H. Lawrence.
Three marks.
Lawrence.
on quickly before he quotes. It is Powell. Jean Valjean. V-A-L-J-E-A-N. Jean Valjean.
Yeah, that's a very old friend from the Miserables, Les Misérables.
By?
By Victor Hugo.
And he was?
He had mighty thews, too. He had a very long life. He began as a convict.
Yes.
And he escaped. Stop me if you've heard this one. Do you want me to go on?
No, that's fine. I was hoping you were going to say what he used the fuse for.
There was a moment when he lifted a farm cart.
That's it. He lifted a farm cart near the end of the book.
There was a fuse, yes.
Jean Valjean, Hero of Les Miserables by Victor Hugo. Dennis Norton, Captain Ahab.
Well, he was the chap who was out to get Moby Dick.
Yes. And by?
By shooting him with a harpoon. written by Melville, Herman Melville.
Yep. Leading character, apart from Wade himself, in Moby Dick by Herman Melville. 3 marks, well done. And now we come to the last round and go back to the quotations I gave to the two teams earlier on. The 2 marks, Nancy Spain, I'd like the origin of your quotation, and it was, "Put not your trust in princes."
Well, it's in the Psalms.
Yes, you're quite right.
And somebody said it about Henry VIII. Thomas Cromwell
quoted it. Yes, Psalm 146. And Dillis Power, the origin of yours, which was, "Here lies one whose name was writ in water."
That's an epitaph. It's Keats, isn't it?
Yes.
Keats, is it?
Written by
himself.
Yes, written by himself. And now I ask Dennis and Frank to tell me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever unlikely story or explanation receives the larger amount of applause from you, the studio audience. So back to Dennis Norton and his quotation, "Put not your trust in princes."
I'd like to refer you to another quotation, "Publish and be damned." It is a phrase that very nearly led to my downfall. I'll tell you how it came about. There's a time of life where you realize that some things that have never happened to you are not going to happen. I realized this last when I was looking through the honors list. Nothing. I looked through all the barons and the knights and the OBs and the MBs. Nothing. I didn't even get a book token as runner-up. And I got thinking of all the other things that I had never achieved and never would achieve now. I'd never write a great novel. I'd never dance a paso doble. I was thinking about this and suddenly I thought, why should these things go past me? Why shouldn't I make a resolution about one of them? Why shouldn't I learn one of these dances and really do it? And of course, the dance to learn now, you can't mess about, is the twist. I thought, why shouldn't I? But it's all the go. I could do it. I know it's decadent and lascivious and all that, and it's a symbol of the decay of modern civilization. I can decay, you know, as well. And so I set about it. You see, I bought this book called How to Dance the Twist. Now, I don't know if you ever tried to learn to dance a dance from a book. And it says things like, put the feet 6 inches apart, move them to the left, to the right, to the left, to the right, moving only the feet, the knees, and the thighs and the hips, not moving the shoulders and moving the hands in the opposite direction. You try doing this all by yourself in a room with the rest of your family rattling the door handle and saying, are you going to be all day in there? And I realized I've got the physical movement, but I wasn't doing the twist. It didn't look right in the mirror, you know. And I saw that the twist is more than just the physical movements. It's a state of mind. It's a complete sort of psychological disturbance. It's method dancing, see. And once I saw that, I was away. I could do it. I
the last, what, 8 weeks at the local Palais, I've won three silver teaspoons and an embroidered coat hanger. That's not bad. Right. And I got this kind of flushed with success and triumph, and I thought, this is what's wrong with books that tell you how to dance. They just give you the physical movements. They don't give you the psychological background to the dance. So I wrote a book called Twist or Bust, and it showed the kind of psychodynamic motivation of the twist, you see. And if you read this, you were induced into the twist rather than just show the physical thing. And it would have been all right, except, you see, I got so carried away by this psychological thing that I went a bit wrong on the actual physical movements. I got a bit muddled up about the left foot and the right foot. So consequence was, of the people who bought it, three of them broke a leg, two of them sprained that ligament at the back of the knee, and one of them twisted his hip practically up as far as his armpit. And I've been sued for damages by all these people, and I'm still in the process of paying. So reverting to what I originally said, I would amend the statement, publish and be damned. I would say, yes, publish and be damned, but with one exception. Put not your twist in print, sirs.
Lit up the bathroom path there. I don't know where you were. Now we go back to Frank Muir, and you can remember his quotation was, "Here lies one whose name was writ in water."
I like people very much. I'm a great believer in people. Without people, if one walked into a deserted street, one couldn't say there aren't many people about, are there? Yes, I like people, but the one man I've met who really loved people was a man called Keats. I met him, you know, on a train. I was going up to Hull at the time because I was at a dance hall dancing a pasodoble with a girl which I danced rather well, actually. And I said, will I see you here next Saturday? And she said, I'll see you in Hull first. So I bought this ticket to Hull, you see. I was sitting in the dining car for lunch, and there I met Keats, this man Keats. He was this waiter in the dining car. He was small, and he had a sort of very thin neck which stuck out of his rather frayed collar, like a vulture's neck. Huge boots he had, really enormous boots. Awfully nice man. And he eventually banged something down in front of me, breathing heavily, and he sort of champed, you know, champed. He seemed to be, I suppose, about 82 or something. And he bent over me and banged something down, laid a plate full of stuff, and I looked at it, and I said, is this the cod or the veal vol-au-vent? And we both peered at it rather miserably for a while. So he said, which did you order? So I said, the cod. And he said, it's the cod. Because I don't want you to go traipsing back to the cookery bit, because it's me feet. He said, you should see my toes. Like globe artichokes they are. And he took his boot off and rested it carefully against my roll and butter. He had no difficulty taking his boot off, because although it was a large boot, it was about a small foot, and there was a sort of inch clearance all around the foot. And he showed me his foot. It was his right foot. And he says, can I sit down, because I've come over wobbly. So he sat down, and he said, I'm not getting the food, I can't eat this muck. He uses his fingers in the kitchen there a lot, and it's horrible, and I can't eat it. And I'm, you know, so I gave him a drink of water, and he said, I should retire, really, I'm a rotten waiter. So I said, why do you carry on with this? He said, I love people. The only way I can meet people is being a waiter. But I'm bad with my hands, I'm a clumsy man. I have been. for the 68 years I've been a... I should have been a brain worker. I'm the world's worst waiter, sir. But it's been a lovely life, a lovely life. And that's the last I ever saw of him. But about 2 months ago, I was staying in the country with some enemies. And it was a very long weekend. And I had my hay fever came back. And the only way I can stop my hay fever is going and sitting in a country churchyard. I got the doctor's call, Gray's allergy. And, I was sitting in the country churchyard, and the sexton came up and said, "Would you like to see Keats' tombstone while you're here?" So I said, "I'd love to." He took me over, and there was this simple marble slab, and chiseled in it were these words, and I'm sure they were Keats' own epitaph. It said, "Here lies Ron, whose name was Rotten Waiter."
Pathos at the end, because up to that moment you've been absolutely revolting story. But it seems to have won your vote, so I give my mark, your mark, to Frank Muir. And that leads us to a final score in which Nancy Spain and Dennis Norden win by 1.5 marks from Dillis Bowe and Frank Muir, and it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longmond. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. Thank you.